KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The text between Trump officials discussing a military strike in Yemen are now public. We'll ask Senator Mark Kelly, a combat veteran, what he thinks the Senate should do now. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Someone in Elon Musk's Doge Group has access to a sensitive Social Security database, government human resource files, and student loan data. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Martinez. Why is he the only person in the country that gets to see all that data? Also, an American hostage returns home from Russia but faces a bureaucratic nightmare, and why some doctors charge thousands of dollars just to let you in the door. It's Thursday, March 27th. Happy anniversary to Mariah Carey, who refuses to use the word birthday, so today is the 56th anniversary of her birth. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Department of Health and Human Services is now the latest federal agency to announce big layoffs. The agency says it will dismiss 10,000 full-time employees. Officials say it's in line with President Trump's DOGE efforts. The agency says Medicare and Medicaid will remain intact. Stocks open lower this morning as President Trump opens a new front in his trade war. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 20 points in early trading.
Auto stocks were mostly lower after President Trump ordered a 25% tax on all imported cars and car parts beginning next week. The tariff, which is 10 times the current import levy, is intended to boost domestic auto production. It's also expected to make it more expensive to buy a new vehicle, and other countries are likely to retaliate with higher tariffs of their own on U.S. exports. In an overnight social media post, Trump warned Europe and Canada could face even higher tariffs if they try to retaliate. Revised figures from the Commerce Department show the U.S. economy grew slightly faster at the end of last year than initially reported. GDP expanded at an annual rate of 2.4% in October, November, and December. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Trump administration is beginning to step away from voting rights lawsuits that were first brought during the Biden administration. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports voting rights advocates fear this could weaken legal protections against racial discrimination in elections.
The Justice Department dropped its lawsuit over Texas redistricting maps and its case against the Georgia County's election system, both that claimed the collective power of voters of color was being diluted in violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Former DOJ official Gilda Daniels says she's concerned some Republican state officials are trying to block people from bringing these kinds of lawsuits.
If you actually make it harder to demonstrate that a Section 2 violation exists, and at an administration that is reluctant and or unwilling to bring Section 2 cases, it could lead to dormancy that I don't think we want to see as a democracy.
Georgia officials have asked the DOJ to drop its case against the state's election laws. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News, Washington.
Congressional Democrats want to know whether top Trump officials put national security at risk when they recently communicated war plans on a commercial messaging app. Some of the Trump officials testified before Senate and House Intelligence Committees this week. Colorado Democratic Congressman Jason Crow is one committee member. He says the Trump administration should stop downplaying this very serious issue.
What the Trump administration is saying is, you know what, the people at the top, they run by different rules. They're protected and the rules don't apply to them, which of course sends a message that, you know, culture is dysfunctional and sends a message down the chain of command that these things don't matter. So that's where things start deteriorating within organizations, and that's where people end up getting killed.
He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. You're listening to NPR from Washington. Vice President Vance is embarking on a trip to Greenland this week. The trip is fraught. That's because President Trump continues to emphasize that the United States will take over the world's largest island, a territory of Denmark. The trip was originally planned as a cultural visit led by the vice president's wife. She was supposed to see Greenland's national dog sled race, but that part of the visit was called off as Greenlanders voice anger over Trump's statements. Now, NPR's Joe Hernandez reports the Vances will visit the only U.S. military base on the island.
Bidufeek Space Base is a Space Force installation on the northwestern coast of Greenland. Its location between the northern U.S. and Russia is critical to the U.S. military, says Troy Bouffard, a professor of Arctic security at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
The center sector there with that base is absolutely paramount.
The military conducts missile warning, missile defense, and space surveillance missions there. Construction on the base began in secret in 1951 in a joint effort between the U.S. and Denmark, which partially controls Greenland. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
The rest of Major League Baseball has its opening day today. 28 of the 30 teams will be in action. The league's official opening day actually started last week in Japan. That is where the Chicago Cubs and the Los Angeles Dodgers kicked off the regular 2025 season. The Dodgers took both games over the Cubs in what was called the Tokyo Series. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Everyone can now read that group chat among senior national security officials who are discussing airstrikes in Yemen.
But that doesn't mean the story is over. Democrats say they still have questions about how the Trump administration is handling national security. Republicans, meanwhile, say it's time to focus on what they are calling a successful bombing campaign against the Houthis in Yemen.
For more, we're joined by NPR's Greg Myrie. Greg, Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee really grilled top national security officials yesterday. What should we take away from that?
Yeah, shortly before the hearing, The Atlantic magazine published details of the group chat on March 15th among the top security officials. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth gave the timing for the attacks 2 hours before they began, and he laid out a timeline for the warplanes and the drones and how they would take off and when. Now, Democrats said this was a major security failure, providing details of an imminent military strike on the publicly available messaging app Signal, and as we know, they included Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor of The Atlantic. Here's Democrat Jason Crow of Colorado, who served as an Army Ranger in Iraq and Afghanistan.
It is completely outrageous to me that administration officials come before us today with impunity. Nobody is willing to come to us and say this was wrong. This was a breach of security and we won't do it again.
So how are Trump administration officials responding?
Well, CIA Director John Ratcliffe essentially said there's just nothing to see here.
I used an appropriate channel to communicate sensitive information It was permissible to do so. I didn't transfer any classified information.
And Defense Secretary Hegseth, writing on X, was also adamant that there was no classified information released, and other officials have said the same. Now, President Trump has been saying the same thing. He was a bit more ambiguous when asked Wednesday evening if he still thought that no classified information was disclosed. He said, quote, "That's what I've heard. I don't know. I'm not sure. You have to ask the various people involved."
All right. So if there's no formal investigation, I mean, what's going to happen now?
Well, Democrats say they'll keep pressing for details in this particular case, like whether national security officials have been using Signal for other chats, because, you know, it's more convenient, though clearly not as secure as government communication networks. More broadly, the Democrats are questioning Trump's foreign policy. Trump has boasted about efforts to arrange ceasefires in Gaza and the Ukraine war, but the Gaza ceasefire between Israel and Hamas has collapsed. Russia and Ukraine are still attacking each other despite U.S. mediation efforts. So these haven't been quick successes that Trump had hoped for.
All right, so the bombing campaign in Yemen that the Trump administration say was successful. Enough evidence so far to say that?
Hey, not yet. Now, the U.S. forces have bombed the Houthis now for nearly 2 weeks, but we're getting relatively little information. Trump's team says the campaign will be much more robust than it was under the Biden administration, and that they'll halt the Houthi attacks on commercial shipping in the Red Sea, which the Houthis describe as solidarity with the Palestinians. But the Houthis have proved very tough, and it's just not clear whether a U.S. bombing campaign, even if it's sustained for a while, can end these attacks and return shipping to normal levels.
All right, that's NPR's Greg Myrie. Greg, thanks.
Sure thing, eh?
And we'll note here that NPR CEO Catherine Marr chairs the board of the nonprofit Signal Foundation.
Yesterday's hearing in the House followed one the day before in the Senate, where Democrat Mark Kelly sits on the Intelligence Committee. He heard from the same five officials who testified to the House, including Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard and CIA Director John Ratcliffe. Senator Kelly of Arizona joins us now for his reaction to both of this week's hearings. He also sits on the Senate Armed Services Committee and is a Navy combat veteran. Good morning, Senator. Thanks for coming back.
Good morning, Michelle. Thank you for having me on.
So I want to start by drawing on your perspective as someone who flew multiple combat missions. What do you make of the revelation that top intelligence officials were communicating about upcoming U.S. airstrikes in Yemen using that messaging app Signal?
Well, it's incredibly reckless. When I saw the details of what was shared over Signal by the Secretary of Defense, I was shocked. And there should be consequences for this kind of recklessness. When you are talking about time of launch off of an aircraft carrier, what type of airplanes, including beyond that MQ-9s, Tomahawk missiles, time over target, these are the most sensitive pieces of information that any military has. An impending strike where you're having service members being put in harm's way.
So there was a moment during yesterday's hearing when Democratic Congressman Joaquin Castro questioned claims from the administration that the information in the messages was not classified. Let me just play that.
The idea that this information, if it was presented to our committee, would not be classified, y'all know is a lie. That's ridiculous. I've seen things much less sensitive be presented to us with high classification. And to say that it isn't is a lie to the country.
As you just said, I mean, the text published included aircraft being flown, when they launched, what specific weapons they were using, that, as you just recounted. So why does it matter whether this information was classified or not? If it wasn't classified, as they say, does that alleviate your concerns?
Well, it was certainly pulled from a classified document. I think they're just trying to deflect that there were no markings on this signal chain. But this information, whether it came specifically from a document that the Secretary of Defense was copying, or it was shared to him over a phone, maybe even a secure phone, he put on an unsecured system. And I flew combat missions, 39 of them, over Iraq and Kuwait in the first Gulf War. If the Iraqis had this kind of information, knowing that I'm going to be over the target at this time, it alerts them that you're coming, and they're going to be much more focused. They know where the aircraft carrier is generally. They know the direction you're coming from. This is the kind of thing that gets people killed. And there has to be accountability for this. It's the right thing to do for our service members. They're not going to trust the system if you have the Secretary of Defense and other officials out there being so careless and reckless about this type of information.
So what do you think should happen now?
Well, there needs to be an investigation. Roger Wicker, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee that I sit on, said this the other day. Some of my other colleagues, I know they're very disturbed by what happened here. And ultimately, my view is that the Secretary of Defense should resign. When he was confirmed or before his confirmation vote, you know, I asked my colleagues, is it worth the risk to have this person leading the Department of Defense? Our service members and our national security deserve more than Pete Hegseth. He's unqualified for this job. And if he doesn't resign, the president should fire him.
So Senator Wicker said he's looking for the Defense Department's Inspector General to investigate this, and I think you agree with that. But President Trump fired the DOD Inspector General. So is there somebody in that position?
He fired inspectors general across the country. So you got to get somebody in that position. You have to put a competent person in that position to investigate this mess of a national security blunder. I think it's almost, some of this stuff is almost comical, by the way, Michelle. At the end of this text message, the Secretary of Defense puts, we are currently clean on OPSEC. That is operational security. That's what he said. On an unsecured message app where this information could have gotten into the hands of the Russians or the Iranians or the Houthis.
So just to be really clear about this, the president fired inspectors general across these agencies. Is there someone in place who could actually undertake an investigation like the one that Senator Wicker and you are calling for?
You could ask possibly the FBI to investigate it. Maybe you find a qualified inspector general from another agency temporarily assign them to DOD for this. That's what the White House should be focused on right now.
And Senator Wicker is one of a handful of Republicans who have publicly voiced concerns. Do you think this is a bipartisan concern or not?
Oh, it absolutely is. My other Republican colleagues that are concerned about this privately need to come off the sidelines. And you need to speak truth to power when things like this happen that put service members at physical risk of getting killed, more American casualties. You got to stand up and say something to the White House.
So before we let you go, are there any other measures that you and the committee you sit on are working on? You know, recognizing the Democrats are in the minority in both the House and the Senate, and so their opportunity to, you know, demand other measures are limited. But are there any other measures or steps that you can take to express your concerns?
Well, we can continue to focus on this and explain it to the American people. This should be important to them. Young men and women, we all know folks in the military, family members, friends, their children that are going overseas, they're in harm's way. We've got to take steps to protect them. We've got to be careful. So I think the American people care about this. I know Americans care about folks that serve in the military. So we have to continue to talk about this until we get to the bottom of it. And then we've got to expect our highest officials here to use secure systems. They have to stop doing this kind of communication on unsecured apps like Signal.
That is Senator Mark Kelly. He's a Democrat, and he's from Arizona. Senator, and as we mentioned, a combat veteran. Senator Kelly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
I want to mention that we extended invitations to representatives of the White House and every member of the Trump administration who was in that Signal chat group, along with Republican lawmakers. All either declined or did not respond to our requests for interviews. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Syria may be on the verge of a new era of unity, or it may descend into anarchy, and the outcome will affect the Middle East and the U.S. Syria's transitional president founded the Syrian branch of Al-Qaeda, but he's now preaching inclusivity. We'll talk with Robert Wirth of The Atlantic about his reporting. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Progressive. Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks, at progressivecommercial.com. From Workday, Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Some nations and terrorist groups use hostages as bargaining chips. Negotiating their release is often time-consuming and complicated. It took the cooperation of several countries last summer for the U.S. and Russia to complete the largest prisoner swap since the Cold War. Paul Whelan, a 55-year-old retired U.S. Marine, was freed in the exchange. He had been held for more than 5 years, but since returning home to Michigan, he says he still feels trapped, this time in a web of bureaucracy. WDET's Quinn Kleinfelter explains.
Last August, a crowd of reporters and photographers gathered at Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland and trained their cameras on a small plane that had just touched down. The first to emerge was a tall, light-haired man with glasses who steadied himself on the hand railings before he snapped off a crisp salute.
It was Paul Whelan, who has been serving a sentence for years.
A CNN announcer described Whelan's actions.
Now embracing the President of the United States of America after a lengthy conversation as he's turning his head towards the family members that await him, waving back to the crowd as America waves back.
But Whelan says the excitement about his return soon faded.
What we found is that once you're home, you're actually on your own. You know, the attention turns on the next guy that's still locked up somewhere abroad.
Whelan was arrested on false espionage charges in December of 2018 and waited years to be freed while the U.S. negotiated the release of other American captives. After the first year of his detention, his employer, BorgWarner, cut his job as director of global security and his insurance coverage. When he finally arrived home, Whelan found that he did not qualify for unemployment because he had not worked in Michigan recently.
Well, I was working, but I was working in a Russian labor camp, and that apparently doesn't count.
A member of Congress had to contact Michigan's Secretary of State just for Whelan to get a driver's license and identification. And being convicted of a crime in Russia, even a crime the U.S. government declared was bogus, created problems.
When I applied for a renewal of my global entry card, which comes from Customs and Border Patrol, I had a hard time with them because they kept focusing on the fact that, well, you were arrested and you were imprisoned overseas. And I said, yeah, and look at the pictures of the president meeting me at Andrews Air Force Base when I came back.
Strangest of all, he says, was when he tried to get full Medicaid coverage through the state.
I had applied for medical care and I had a letter back saying that I didn't qualify because I wasn't a U.S. citizen. It makes you scratch your head, to be quite honest. I mean, how could somebody have sent that to me? But they did. And I said, you know, you could just Google my name right now.
It's not supposed to be that difficult for returning hostages. Congress created the Levinson Act specifically to provide medical and other help to them and their families for 5 years after their release. But Congress never funded it. Michigan Congresswoman Haley Stevens says there's a bipartisan effort to add that appropriation.
Someone like Paul Whelan, 5.5 years taken from him. If he was wrongfully in prison in the United States, he'd arguably get compensation. Paul Whelan right now is living off of a GoFundMe, and it's unacceptable, and it's wrong.
Whelan lives with his elderly parents in the small village of Manchester, roughly 60 miles southwest of Detroit, and he says he literally depends on the kindness of strangers. At the Manchester Diner, owner Leslie Kirkland has a job tip, offering to connect Whelan with a regular customer who runs a cybersecurity company.
Try and talk to him this weekend. I know he'll come in for chicken and waffles, and I can see if he's got something for you or he can put you in the right direction for something.
Whelan smiles, then glances at his phone. He's just got a message from another former hostage, one of several who text each other regularly, seeking advice and encouragement.
It's a small community, but we keep in touch. Sort of like a group of misfit toys.
Whelan talks about support he's received from the community, the car dealers who've offered him a leased vehicle, and the private practitioners that provided him with some medical and dental help.
But the reality is that when you get off the plane, you find that your former life isn't there. The homes that we've left are not the homes that we come back to. It's a process of putting puzzle pieces together yourself.
Whelan says if he can help the government develop new methods to support anyone else who might be detained, maybe his half decade in the darkest corners of the Russian prison system will count for more than just time taken away from him. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
The remnants of Hurricane Helene hit Appalachia hard. Flooding there 6 months ago killed more than 100 people, and millions lost water and power. Archivists are now trying to preserve the history of that experience. Here's Katie Myers with Blue Ridge Public Radio and Grist.
The first time water came back on after over 50 days without, captured on video by a thrilled Asheville resident identified only as Lexi B. Then there's this. Local singer-songwriter Michael Hatch adapting a classic Dolly Parton song to reflect on his experience of the storm. These clips are all a part of a project called Come Hell or High Water by Western North Carolina archivists. Catherine Cutchell manages the archive in a library in Asheville. It already has collections from previous disasters, like photographs and letters from the catastrophic 1916 flood.
We have the responsibility and ability to gather things that are happening right now. History happens every single day.
And now a lot of it is digital media. They've gotten over 200 submissions.
We are all archivists now, especially in the social media age.
Across Appalachia, archivists are making sure flood histories don't get lost. After a 1,000-year flood in 2022 swamped eastern Kentucky, archivists there cleaned the mud from thousands of tapes and records. This is a flood damage tape by old-time Appalachian musicians Oxy Caudill and Ernest Adams. It was salvaged and digitized by the Apple Shop Archive in eastern Kentucky. They've saved a lot, said Shane Terry, the institution's archive technician.
It's beautifully sad.
He said the scale of recent disasters in Appalachia have made regional collaboration important.
We can help each other out with maybe digital storage or physical storage.
Like all archivists, Catherine Cutchell hopes that their work can help future generations learn from the past.
One of the things that I'm really looking forward to is understanding how community members might look at those historical documents to inform the way that we advocate for ourselves moving forward and build a more climate-resilient Asheville.
Looking into the future, she said, we have the tools to keep preserving Appalachian history at our fingertips in our growing digital world. For NPR News, I'm Katie Myers in Asheville.
This is NPR News.
The war between Russia and Ukraine is now largely being fought with drones. And while Ukraine is at the cutting edge of drone innovation, Russia isn't far behind.
Once you've got a technology, other side tries to counter. It's a constant war of innovations and war of technologies.
I'm Elsa Chang. Ukraine and Russia's fight for the skies. On All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Congressional Democrats are calling for a high-level investigation into how a journalist was added to a group discussion by top Trump officials on the Signal messaging app about plans for U.S. airstrikes in Yemen targeting Houthi rebels. The chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee and the panel's top Democrat are asking the acting Inspector General of the Defense Department to investigate. In Berlin, NPR's Rob Schmitz says a German newspaper is reporting it's located sensitive information online for some of these same officials.
According to an investigation by Der Spiegel, the private cell phone numbers, email addresses, and in some cases passwords of Trump's top security advisors were found via customer data published online. Spiegel found personal contacts for National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, National Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard, and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. Spiegel's investigation showed that as of Wednesday, privately used and publicly searchable phone numbers belonging to Gabbard and Waltz were still linked to Signal accounts. Gabbard, Waltz, and Hegseth were among top Trump administration officials in a Signal chat group last week. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
NPR CEO Catherine Marr chairs the board of the Signal Foundation, a nonprofit that supports the messaging app. This is NPR News from Washington. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says the department is cutting 20,000 full-time jobs in a major restructuring of the federal agency. It's part of President Trump's effort to downsize government. This is opening day for nearly all of the teams in Major League Baseball. As Steve Futterman reports from Los Angeles, the Dodgers are the defending World Series champions.
They won baseball's biggest prize last year.
Your Dodgers have won the World Series!
And the LA Dodgers are the favorites once again. The Dodgers, with baseball's largest payroll, are led by superstar Shohei Ohtani, along with several new big-name free agents. The most sought-after free agent, Juan Soto, is playing with the New York Mets. One team, the Oakland A's, has moved since last season. Eventually, the A's are set to play in Las Vegas. But a new stadium isn't due to be ready until 2028, so this year they will play in Sacramento. There will be ceremonial first pitches at each of 14 games. In Washington, the honor will go to longtime baseball writer Tom Boswell. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
The Dodgers and the Chicago Cubs officially kicked off the 2025 season last week with a pair of games at the Tokyo Dome in Japan. Stocks are higher on Wall Street. The Dow is up 10 points. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. From the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at CIDQ.org/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Fewer than 50 people have the highest level of access to the Social Security Administration databases with hundreds of millions of people's personal and private financial information.
But only one person also has access to federal student loan data and the government's human resources files.
That's what NPR's Stephen Fowler found after reviewing thousands of pages of federal court records in lawsuits challenging the Department of Government Efficiency team's access to data. He's been digging into these court cases. He's here now, Stephen. So tell us about this person with all that access and why it's a big deal.
Well, court filings show it's a DOGE employee named Akash Boba. He's one of a few people that's been given carte blanche access to see all of these different sensitive financial and personal data repositories across multiple federal agencies. A, it is normal for a small group of employees to be able to have complete access to these databases. And Trump's DOGE executive order did direct agencies to set up teams to look through the data to find, quote, waste, fraud, and abuse. But these sources are all supposed to be compartmentalized. The people who access Social Security's master beneficiary record are not the people who can see everything about student loan borrowers, are not the people who can go through the government's HR files until now.
So I know there have been lots of lawsuits around DOGE and what it has access to. So what sort of legal and privacy concerns do these suits raise?
So piecing together all of the different lawsuits and combining what we know from there, there's a few different buckets that all point towards this. DOGE giving conflicting answers about what data it's accessed, who has that access, and most importantly, why. One, records show these staffers were sometimes brought on board without having proper training on handling personally identifiable information. Two, there have been filings where the government admits it can't account for when or how these DOGE staffers access the data, and that also includes a revelation that one person sent personally identifiable information to other government employees outside the agency. Which brings us to three. It's something called the Privacy Act that's in place to ensure information included in these databases is not disclosed to anybody who does not need to know. The government's response has been DOGE needs to know to be able to find waste, fraud, and abuse, which they haven't found yet either. And the White House never responded to our questions about whether DOGE was following privacy laws or whether this level of access should concern Americans.
Okay, so how are the courts then responding to the Trump administration's arguments?
They largely have not seen why DOGE needs everything everywhere all at once instead of a more tailored approach. I mean, one judge even called it like hitting a fly with a sledgehammer shortly before blocking DOGE from Social Security data. Another judge warned that, quote, a real possibility exists that sensitive information has already been shared outside the Treasury Department. And on Monday, a different judge temporarily halted DOGE from accessing data on millions of union members through the Office of Personnel Management, Treasury, and Education Departments, finding that the DOGE employees had, quote, no need to know the vast amount of data shared. There's more than a dozen cases dealing with access right now, and these rulings aren't the end-all be-all right now, but it's one of many things about government restructuring we're keeping track of in coming weeks.
All right, that's NPR's Stephen Fowler in Atlanta. Stephen, thanks.
Thank you.
There's a shortage of primary care doctors across the country and long wait times for appointments. Some doctors are overhauling their practices to adapt. But Karen Brown with New England Public Media reports they could be making the shortage even worse.
Michelle Andrews had been happy with her doctor in Western Massachusetts for about 10 years. She did notice it was harder to get an appointment, but she was not prepared for the letter that arrived last summer.
Writing to inform of this exciting change they'll be making, and as of September 1st, they're switching to concierge membership practice.
Concierge medicine is where a doctor charges a yearly or monthly membership fee to their patients, who are still paying insurance copays and deductibles. In exchange, the doctor has fewer patients overall, so it's easier to get more timely and longer appointments. According to One Trade magazine, there are about 12,000 concierge practices in the country.
Second paragraph tells me the yearly fee for joining will be $1,000 per year for existing patients.
And some practices charge as much as $50,000 a year. Andrews and her husband were given 3 months to pay or leave the practice. They left.
I'm insulted and I'm offended. I would never, never expect to have to pay more out of my pocket to get the kind of care that I should be getting with my insurance premiums.
Another patient, Patty Healy, got the same letter, but had a different reaction.
I didn't question it.
As a retired nurse herself, Healy knew she'd have a heck of a time finding a new doctor.
And it might be to my benefit, because maybe I'll get earlier appointments.
This is the conundrum of concierge medicine. The quality of care may go up for those who pay.
But that means fewer people have access. So each time any physician makes that switch, it exacerbates the shortage.
Michael Dill is with the Association of American Medical Colleges. He says the impact of concierge care is worse in rural areas.
Even one or two make that switch, you're going to feel it.
But Dr. Shane Taylor says that's not the fault nor the responsibility of doctors like her.
We cannot spend so much time seeing so many patients and documenting in such a way to get an extra $17 from the insurance company.
Taylor recently opened a direct care practice in Northampton, Massachusetts. Direct care is a version of concierge that bypasses insurance altogether. Taylor set membership at $225 per month. While traditional practices might have up to 2,000 patients per doctor, Taylor now caps her patient load at 300.
We get a lot of pushback because people are saying, oh, this is elitist and this is only going to be accessible to people that have money. But ultimately, the numbers don't work.
Some of the pushback on the membership model comes from other physicians. Dr. Paul Carlin runs Valley Medical Group in Western Mass. They're more stretched than ever. One reason is they're absorbing some of the patients who have lost their doctor to concierge medicine.
We all contribute through our tax dollars, which fund these training programs.
Carlin is referring to the fact that the federal government pays the salaries of doctors during their residency training after medical school.
And so we should be worried when folks are making decisions about how to practice that reduce their capacity to deliver that good back to the public.
Michelle Andrews, the patient who did not follow her doctor into concierge care, eventually found a new doctor. But she's still angry at the system and at concierge doctors.
You're not fighting the system. This is a workaround the system.
But for Dr. Shane Taylor, she says it was either the membership model or leaving medicine. And serving only 300 patients is still better than serving zero. For NPR News, I'm Karen Brown in Northampton, Massachusetts.
This story comes from NPR's partnership with New England Public Media and KFF Health News. This is NPR News.
A young woman with ALS humorously documents her experience, including some awkward moments talking to family and friends about the terminal illness. Next time in Here and Now.
NPR is on the radio, online, and at your fingertips, wherever you go. Stay connected. Take the news with you on your smartphone. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org.
Good morning, May Martinez. Which state will be the first to have an official hip-hop song? North Carolina is considering Raise Up by Petey Pablo. Tennessee is thinking about, well, Tennessee by Arrested Development. Thankfully, here in California, yeah, we got that covered. California. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19, the CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle, has a new show on Netflix. It's called With Love, Meghan, and in it, Markle, or Meghan Sussex, as she tells us she now wants to be known, offers tips on homemaking and entertains guests at a beautiful California estate. So, pretty typical lifestyle show. It's already been picked up for another season. So why all the hate, the snarky memes, the takedown pieces? Leslie Gray Streeter thinks she knows. Earlier this month, she published a column with the Baltimore Banner. Its headline, The Real Reason People Are Mad at Meghan Markle's new lifestyle show, and she's with us now to tell us more about it. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I love this subject. I get so many comments about it. So,
okay, so out with it. What's the real reason?
The real reason is, I'm going to say racism and jealousy that is couched in racism and a little classism and just, you know, basically being mad that people have things that we might want that we don't have, and then racism.
And what makes you convinced of that?
Well, I think it's because the response to her from so many quarters has always been couched in race. And I think that in this thing, it kind of shocks people, even though you know at this point she's royalty and you know that she is very wealthy. But seeing her having a soft life, having a life where she can be at leisure to have bees in her backyard and make fruit rainbows and balloon arches seems like that's the final straw. Something about that offends people.
So you mentioned a soft life. What is a soft life, and why do you think it seems to trigger some people?
A soft life, if you look at things like The Barefoot Contessa or anything in a Nancy Meyers movie, where it's just a person who is probably a woman who has means, who can like sip, you know, Chardonnay in a white sweater looking off the coast of her huge kitchen, you know, onto the deck or whatever. But I think that the soft life part comes with money. And it comes with money to buy the time to do that. And that is not something I think that women of African descent are expected to have. And I think, once again, the idea of what Black femininity is not that.
Okay, let me just push back on this a little bit and ask whether, okay, could it be that part of the reason people are hating on her is that they kind of hate on women anyway? I mean, that the internet is famous for hating on women. Like, for example, like Martha Stewart has been satirized for years because she is like Meghan Markle in the sense that she's a hobbyist.
Well, that's certainly part of it. I wrote a story actually when Martha's show, the documentary, came out on Netflix about that, about the fact that people resent her because she doesn't try to be nice. I think that the Black piece adds a, if anyone is supposed to be in a palatial estate making, you know, mountains out of cream cheese or something with a very expensive knife, it's not Meghan Markle.
Hmm. Well, the final line in your piece, which is one that I think a lot of people passed around to each other, you're saying one of the problems here is that people want her to make herself smaller. What does that mean?
I think in this, and even in our professional lives, women, all women, and I think particularly women of color, are expected to be self-deprecating, to not take too much credit lest we be called arrogant or intimidating. But I think that for something like this, so many people are talking about it. Some of them are hating, and I think most people are loving. And also, I don't know who has enough time in the world to devote to something that they hate. So just don't watch it. There's some other show for you. Do that.
Leslie Gray Streeter is a columnist for the Baltimore Banner. She's also got a novel coming out this June. It's called Family and Other Calamities. Leslie Gray Streeter, thanks so much for talking with us.
So much fun. Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez.
We continue to track the on-the-ground effects of budget cuts in U.S. international aid.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Certified Financial Planner Professionals. Learn more about CFP professionals at letsmakeaplan.org.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. Supporters of the U.S. Agency for International Development are on Capitol Hill today to lobby lawmakers and staffers. The cutting of budgets and jobs at USAID has derailed aid programs around the world. The State Department says it's terminating about 80% of USAID's grants and contracts, and aid groups say even life-saving humanitarian programs that the department had promised to protect are faltering, and children especially could suffer. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer explains.
Mark Moore is racing to make up for lost time. He's CEO of Manna Nutrition, a nonprofit that makes a nutritional paste from peanuts for starving children. He's talking to me from a Manna office in Charlotte, North Carolina. Over Zoom, he points to a pallet of food.
And you can see that USAID logo there.
I see it.
Most of Moore's packets of nutritional paste are sent to Africa. Earlier this year, Moore got a series of emails from his main client, USAID.
It's been a yo-yo effect. First, it was an email in January.
The emails said Moore's contracts were paused. He should stop work. But a week later, he was told to resume operations. But then a few weeks after that, never mind, Moore's contracts were abruptly canceled. USAID said Manna's life-sustaining packets weren't in the national interest. Then the yo-yo bounced up a final time when a week later, Moore was told to restart. He did. Even though the federal government still owes him a lot of money.
Somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 to $25 million.
All this time, Moore was thinking about the children in places like Sudan and Chad who depend on Manna's nutritional paste. He says if these malnourished kids go for a week without food.
For a child under six, especially these children, it'll cost them their life.
Moore says it's all well and good for him to be producing his packets again, but they still have to get to these children. And he says there could be big supply disruptions this summer because of other contract cancellations and payment disruptions for shippers and nonprofits that run feeding centers. If they're not able to restart their work, the outlook is grim. Moore says children will die.
We may not even be able to count them. They will have nowhere to go. So it would probably look like tens of thousands of children dying quietly at home.
In an email, the State Department told me, quote, critical U.S. aid program awards remain active. But Charles Kenny, senior fellow at the Center for Global Development, says for the most part, USAID still isn't able to make payments or issue new contracts. And not just for food aid. Kenny says the U.S. also paid for antiviral drugs for HIV and AIDS patients across the globe.
Without all of that being fixed, we have an emergency of just an awesome scale. I mean, we are talking 3, maybe 4 million deaths over the course of a year.
Kenny says the first victims of any AIDS crisis will be children born to HIV-positive mothers who weren't taking antiviral drugs. He says if those babies don't get antivirals right away, around half of them could die within a year. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
The Dow is little changed. The S&P and the NASDAQ are each up 0.2%. As we follow additional 25% tariffs on imported cars, trucks, and parts, General Motors stock is now down about 8%, Ford down 3.5%, Toyota down 2.4%. Our coverage of cars and trucks likely to get significantly more expensive in the name of Made in America is now on the Marketplace Morning Podcast.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Amazon Business, dedicated to helping businesses save time on office tasks and empower leaders with business buying solutions that support teams to focus on growing the business. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com.
On Capitol Hill yesterday, executives from our industry, public media, faced calls to end the federal government's contribution to funding for public television and public radio. The heads of PBS and NPR appeared at a House hearing with Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, alleging bias in NPR coverage and inappropriate content on PBS television. There was also a focus on funding beyond the government piece, namely the underwriting announcements companies buy. The Trump administration has opened an investigation into whether those have become fully fledged commercials that might break federal rules. Now, public television and public radio organizations say funding models comply with the law. For context here, we spoke to Victor Picard, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication.
Most of the funding for public broadcasting comes actually from donations, sponsorships, grants, you know, from foundations and indeed from corporations. And what has become euphemistically known as underwriting or enhanced underwriting often comes in the form of corporate sponsorship of particular programs.
Picard says government rules evolved over decades with less federal subsidy available.
There were rule changes, especially in the early 1980s at the FCC, that actually made it easier and loosened restrictions on how public broadcasting stations could announce sponsorship on the air, for example, and just kind of incentivized almost, you might say, public broadcasters to seek out this kind of corporate sponsorship.
Congresswoman Taylor Greene argued yesterday that eliminating federal funding for public media is a matter of economic priorities.
The United States is $36 trillion in debt. In fiscal year 2024, the government spent over $1.8 trillion more than it took in. And in fiscal year 2025, the interest on our debt is expected to exceed $1 trillion. As we continue investigating waste, fraud, and abuse, we can look no further than the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
The Georgia Congresswoman went on to conclude,
because the reality is, the United States of America is broke and can't afford it.
In 2023, for instance, the main vehicle for government funding for public media, Corporation for Public Broadcasting grants, were at $336 million a year. The industry newspaper called Current looked at how that breaks down state by state and found it to be $1.52 per person in the U.S., but varying by state, 50 cents a year per person in Texas and Georgia, for example, more than $11 a year for Alaskans. Disclosure, this program, Marketplace, benefits from Corporation for Public Broadcasting funding, since the federal subsidy can help local public media stations buy our programming. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.